Hi, this is Jason Taylor. Thanks for downloading this MP3 file, which is about how being nice can lead to war. Now, that doesn't make a lot of sense to most people. They would immediately say, wait a second, being nice prevents war, right? Isn't war the opposite of nice? Therefore, being nice should prevent war. And in this comment, I actually try to show the opposite is true, that being nice actually can lead to war. And in doing so, I'm really just trying to define what I mean by arrogant. Let me explain the background of what led to this comment. And the reason I have to explain the background is because I normally don't release information or take the time to write something up unless I have a motivation. So a lot of my ideas are kept secret and not discussed or disclosed unless there's a motivation for me to do so. In this specific case, the motivation was about something else, and so this is just a comment of a post that I'd already made. And the original post was on Facebook about a video on the SR-71, which probably was one of the greatest inventions of the last century. And if there were ever like a Nobel Prize for engineering, it would have gone to this. But my ideas about conflict and war and biases and disagreement really have nothing to do with this video. This just happened to be the situation where I felt motivated to disclose what I was trying to say. And indeed, I didn't really feel too strongly about the point I was trying to make because this is a marginal case. And that's sort of to be expected because if it weren't a marginal case and the video was just poor overall, everybody would have agreed with me and case closed. There wouldn't have been any need for me to have explained what I was trying to say. So the video sounded real interesting and real jazzy, but its purpose was to explain how the engine of that aircraft worked. And I watched the video and I was a little bit confused. I mean, no, I was confused. I was not too impressed with the ability of them to teach how it worked. To me, it raised more questions than it answered. And it glossed over a whole lot of stuff, and it didn't make a whole lot of sense, and it was just like somebody was reading off all the parts, you know. Now, all of the comments were positive, and there's a couple things going on here, I figured. One is this association bias. I think biases, emotions, and feelings are very useful tools for us to think faster, and they're all very similar. I think that unjustified arrogance is that reluctance to give up a bias. And usually that bias is not known really to the person who's utilizing it, which makes it a little bit tricky. Bias is the foundation for disagreement. And people don't really give enough importance to biases, systemic biases, biases in the way people think. And at the core, if we didn't have bias in our thought, we would pretty much be able to agree on most anything, I think. So a question I've always asked since I was a child is, why are people disagreeing about everything? Why can't we just, you know, like I would ask my father a question and he would tell me the answer, and you know, I'd ask him this, and maybe sometimes we disagree, and I'd, you know, ask other questions. To me, that was a very rational process. And no matter what it was, we could discuss something and agree about it. And I wondered, why are people disagreeing about this issue? Why don't those people that we're killing over there, why don't they understand what we're trying to tell them? And I soon realized that the situation with me and my father is much different from the situation between one country and another country. And the specific difference is that my feelings and things that I believe were firmly true were very similar to the ones that he also felt were firmly true. So that commonality allowed for discussions of new material and which would then be incorporated into my thinking process. However, when you go to a different culture, you have more and more differences. There's less common ground. And the feelings that we all use as the basis for our thought process are different. And so the question is, can people go back to those feelings? And really, I'm going to discuss all of that stuff in this audio tape. So that's why biases come into play when you're thinking about conflict. And so, as I mentioned before, it so happened that the subject of biases came up in this video. Now, this first bias, it's really the Dr. Fox effect. The Dr. Fox effect basically says that if something is really couched in a good induction and all that stuff, that people perceive it as better than it really is. And so people judge by context is what it comes down to. So intonation is used to judge the validity of an argument, and for instance, and sort of a cheap way that some people decide whether somebody is telling the truth or it's a good argument or whatever. And it's just pragmatic that people use that. Here what we have is a great thing. Any video about it that could be bad is actually perceived as good because what they're talking about is good. And so that's the irrationality that goes into that. So that tends to come out when everybody's positive about something. And don't get me wrong, the video really was awesome in a lot of respects. It wasn't doing one thing that everybody else was saying it was doing. The other effect that I saw had to do with how people tend not to believe that they don't understand something. They sort of think they understand stuff when they don't. You see this sometimes, maybe hypothetically speaking, if you had an artist who was the world's famous greatest artist, and you could maybe have that artist make a random set of pixels. Maybe they could use a computer program to make a random painting. And that artist, if they have a good reputation, could, I think, maybe get away as sort of a hoax or a joke with putting up this random set of pixels and having a line of people go up and see this exhibit or opening or whatever. And they would maybe say, wow, this is so profound, you know, and then the next person would not really want to admit that they didn't understand it, so they would be more likely to really truly think that this is really profound, and they would say the same thing. And if you go onto YouTube and you search just right, maybe you'll find this video of, I think it was David Letterman, maybe it was Jimmy Kimmel, I don't know, but before the latest iPhone was being released, they went out and basically took a Casio watch. And I think it even said Casio right on there. I'm not sure, but they went on to New York City street and they went up to people and said, this is the latest iPhone. What do you think? It's a watch. It's iPhone watch, the iWatch. And all these people were raving about it, you know. And that's the kind of brand and reputation that that company has. So getting back to this comment by this retired Air Force mechanic, his name is Dennis Bixby. What he said was, awesome video, great job at explaining how this engine works. And I replied, I think you're being arrogant to write that. And he replied back, what do you mean? Are you just being negative? I don't understand. I don't think the mechanic even understands how the engine works. And not only do I think that the video didn't do a good job explaining it, but he was misleading himself into thinking that he understood it. Because a lot of people can watch a video about, let's say, how something's made, and they deceive themselves into thinking that they really know how it's made or whatever the video is about. And there's a difference between watching a video and knowing how something is done. And a lot of people don't know the difference. And sometimes these people think, oh, I saw the lecture, I watched the video, therefore I'll be able to ace the test, and they don't do that well on the test for that very reason, because the test helps you measure whether somebody actually knows something. So in response to him, I tried to explain a couple of things. I tried to explain why I thought he was being arrogant. I also tried to explain some of the biases. There wasn't enough space because YouTube only has so much space. You can write stuff in. So originally I posted this on Facebook. I posted the hyperlink to the YouTube video and specifically to the comments that are now deleted about the discussion about what is arrogance. and also whether or not people really are that good at educating, which was sort of confusing because the URL actually goes to a comment, but the comment got deleted and Google doesn't tell people that there used to be a comment there, and unless you really look carefully at the URL, you wouldn't know it.
In case you're curious, I really don't know who deleted those comments. I assume it's somebody at Google. It's one of those mysteries that I have not yet solved, why my stuff gets deleted on the internet.
Some of my Facebook friends asked me, what exactly is it that you don't like about this video? Specifically, my band instructor asked me that. I tried to explain to him that, well, I wasn't upset at the video or anything. I was just trying to explain that one of the posters who's commenting about the video is being arrogant, I thought. And in doing that, I also explain how being nice can lead to war. So here's my response to my ex-band instructor.
Mr. Schumacher, the video itself didn't upset me. Rather, it was Dennis's assertion left parenthesis and apparently 100% of a dozen other viewer assertions as well right parenthesis that the video was outstanding at explaining how the engine worked. I disagree very much about this, but my bigger concern is not really about teaching skills or videos. In my opinion, the statements by Dennis and even Scaff are due to the biggest problem facing our society, which is the arrogance problem. I will attempt to explain why, but I should warn you that my beliefs about this are not currently politically correct. I hope they become politically correct someday, since, as I will explain, that would cause world peace. Left parenthesis exclamation mark right parenthesis in the meantime, I am not going to make friends for having or expressing them. My original comment was negative. A question I will try to address here is whether society is correct to generally believe that any sort of direct criticism is itself wrong. For starters, in my opinion, direct criticism is a potential path and opportunity towards improvement. If someone is doing something wrong, letting them know allows them to fix that. Constructive criticism, in moderation, can be the nicest give one can give another, since it can help steer a person onto a path of greater success. Even inflammatory criticism, which is obviously worse generally, can help enable someone with their ears open to learn what they might need to fix or at least pay more attention to. In my opinion, anyone who has a mild disagreement should have the right to openly discuss it, to warn people or foster a discussion leading to something better. Of anything. Even a grievance about a huge injustice, which is the more important question to focus on. In my opinion, that's useful free speech. Now compare criticism to the opposite : the PC speech, which is always to only say positive things. Is any data really in such speech? Consider, more thumbs ups do not actually add that much new information. I'm not really completely alone here. I bet you didn't know that the person who would become the richest in the world once said, I set a rule that people weren't allowed to send good news unless they sent around an equal amount of bad news. But free speech also means those who don't think that there is anything wrong or any injustice are able to refute those upset. Such a direct bi-directional communication would allow both sides to present their opinions. This can allow themselves or an external audience to formulate their own improved opinions. That audience may or may not ultimately be persuaded, be it another YouTube user or some important lawmaker. But if either side is self-censored due to public phobias of using potentially offending words like quote arrogant unquote or quote naive unquote, if even after a false conditional, I argue that ignorance and wrong opinions are the result. And such ignorance allows potential real incorrect views or even crimes left parenthesis since views generally associate to actions right parenthesis to continue as is. This is because if people can't directly see the other side of an issue, they won't change their minds or do anything about the potentially hidden problem. So those easily offended by use of strong words or name-calling can actually foster what they are supposedly opposed to. 20 years ago, Jonathan Rauch, who I'd guess is the primary person who caused gay marriage to be legalized in almost every state in the U.S., said the real problem is this quote humanitarian impulse unquote to protect people from thoughts harmful to their present worldview. Name-calling isn't the problem, it is the conviction and frowning upon of name-calling that is bad. Hyperlink to an interview with Jonathan Rauch. Inserted audio from that interview follows.
Being offended is part of how we learn. If you can't offend people, then you can't criticize people. And if you can't criticize people and ideas, then there is absolutely no way to figure out what ideas are good and what ideas are bad. My name is Jonathan Rauch. I'm a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution in Washington, and I wrote a book a while back called Kindly Inquisitors, The New Attacks on Free Thought. Almost every authority in human history that has tried to enforce one orthodoxy or another, first has got it wrong, and second has been well-intentioned. Whenever anyone tells you, I've got it right, I've got the one true answer, and everyone else is wrong, and I'm going to enforce it, that person is not only a menace to freedom, but more important, a menace to human thriving and human knowledge. And it would be a shame if universities of all places in this country forgot that lesson. The fundamental reason we have universities is to discover knowledge and to convey to students how we discover knowledge. The way we discover knowledge is by starting out with our prejudices, our bigotries, our mistakes, and testing them and throwing away the 99% that's wrong and keeping the rest. But prejudice and bigotry and error are not the enemies of knowledge. They're the raw material of knowledge. The enemy of knowledge is the kind of certitude that won't let you put prejudice and bigotry and error out there and won't let you test it. Because if you can't test the bad stuff in order to weed out the good stuff, all you have is bad stuff. I've been writing as an openly gay advocate of gay equality and now gay marriage for 20 years. And to me, it's been a miracle to witness the power of persuasion in America. As Martin Luther King understood, and as Frank Kameny, the great gay activist, recently died, understood, by far the most important tool that minorities have for obtaining equality in America is our power to change people's mind by our force of argument and by our force of example. So I wrote a book called Kindly Inquisitors about 20 years ago, in which I argued that the biggest threat to freedom of speech in America in many ways is not from the traditional book burners and censors. It's from well-intentioned liberals and progressives in many cases who want to protect minorities and want to protect people from being, as they called it, wounded by words. What they were trying to do, I called it the humanitarian impulse, because basically it was trying to make society a better and kinder place. The problem with that is that it's misguided, because we, members of minorities, we're not delicate flowers. We don't need to be protected from people who don't like us or respect it, because we can't earn their respect or admiration or change their mind by hiding from them. We have got to be in situations where we can confront and encounter them, sometimes angrily, but more often with persuasion. The humanitarian attack basically, unfortunately, stigmatizes criticism. It says hurting people's feeling with words is a bad thing. Well, it's not a good thing, I grant you that, but it's a necessary part of the knowledge creation process. Forcing people into dialogue, forcing them to criticize each other and to encounter ideas that they may not like, that is the purpose of a university, and that is the thing that saves minorities and moves humanity toward newer, better ideas. The core principle for me is the distinction between, on the one hand, what I call purism, and on the other hand, what I call pluralism. Purism is the idea that a society has to be effectively cleansed of prejudice and bigotry and hateful views, because as long as those views are around, minorities are going to feel unsafe or be unsafe. Pluralism is a very different view. It says, bring it on, the more the better. The only really safe situation in society is when you can pit these views against each other and when minorities get their say and have the opportunity to denounce and refute views that are biased and bigoted. I think the right answer, and I think this has been proven by centuries of human experience, is in fact pluralism. We can't trust anybody in authority to make smart decisions for us about what's the acceptable point of view. And I think again and again on college campuses and elsewhere, it's been minorities and others who at the end of the day have stood up and said, you know, if we don't stand up for groups that take the other side, who's going to stand up for us? One of the things that the great writer H.L. Mencken once said is that no good idea was ever born that didn't start out by offending people. Being offended is part of how we learn. If you can't offend people, then you can't criticize people. And if you can't criticize people and ideas, then there is absolutely no way to figure out what ideas are good and what ideas are bad. I'm not for offending people on purpose, but is offendedness an absolutely indispensable part of the process of developing knowledge and living together as a society? Absolutely. And is it a dangerous situation when someone can shut down the search for truth by saying, oh, that offends me? Absolutely.
So that's the YouTube video with Jonathan Rauch. In a nutshell, all he's really saying is that if society doesn't like something, or does like something for that matter, and for whatever reason debate is cut off, even if it's to help a minority or not, things aren't going to change. Naturally, when you cut off debate, you keep things the same. So even if one censors to protect the minority group, it doesn't matter why you did it. That minority group is going to stay in whatever situation. And he is arguing that the reason that we now have the legal right for gays to marry each other is because we sort of broke through that barrier and allowed a little bit of debate. Obviously, it, you know, took a long time. That's why I say a little. But at the end of the day, they have more rights now because people were able to speak out and use reason to further their arguments. So again, it sort of comes back to this, do you want short-term pleasure or long-term pleasure? Because you can't have both optimized completely 100%. You really can go for censorship, which gives you the short-term pleasure. You basically don't have the pain, because you're not going to talk about it. But then there's no more marriage for gays. So you can have no discussion, no pain, except there's no marriage, no benefit in the long run. Or you can go through this very painful period where there's a discussion about whether it's okay for gays to get married within the overall community, within the country. And that painful period where people who hate gays are going to be upset and are going to write letters and all that stuff, and all this negativity is going to occur. You have to go through that period in order to get the benefit in the long run. So it comes back to the other MP3 file that I uploaded today, or will upload today, which is, do you want to be an SL or are you going to be an HL? Do you want to go for the short term or the long term? Now, what's sort of interesting is realistically there's piggybacking. So the vast majority assume and rely upon the outspoken people to sort of break ground and use their machete to go through the forest of opposition and sort of pave the way for what will come in the future. But the question is how many people are willing to do that? Do they have any support? It's strange, but a lot of people don't even understand this, it seems. They sort of think that the people who are outspoken, who are trying to pave the way and is trying to express the beliefs and concepts of a minority group, themselves are sort of causing trouble. And that's unfortunate. And a little bit paradoxical, but really most people don't think about it too much into too much detail, and so I think that's the explanation why. Just a sort of gossip about this video. I also had comments in this video posted that were deleted. They were replies to user Thanatos101B, and the comments were not inflammatory or anything like that. I don't know why they were deleted. I was actually supporting Jonathan Rauch specifically because somebody else was opposing him, and I was trying to explain to her why Jonathan's perspective is correct, and well, or better, I should say. And there my comments again are deleted in a YouTube video, which is ironic, about free speech. And I'm used to getting my comments deleted. I'm used to people telling me that that's impossible, that my stuff on the internet gets deleted. But I'm telling you, I had about 3 comments deleted in this video too. Anyway, that's that video. Let's continue with my post on Facebook.
Quote, humanitarian, unquote, PC, self or external censorship therefore can allow, for example, racists to continue being racists, or abusers to continue abusing. In that latter case, it is because their victims decide to not speak up. They don't want to be accused of discussing a bad topic, using a bad word, name-calling, etc. The situation is such that the truly abused people in this world often voluntarily chose to stay silent. These victims do this on the correct grounds that the world thinks that the crime against them was an unspeakable act. They know that anyone discussing the issue will themselves be deemed vulgar and offensive. The abused or those with minority opinions may also argue the majority view or potential crime was just too traumatic for them. But, usually, the accusers are not current and real threats. In those cases, the victims who chose to be silent are hypocritical. They actually help that crime to continue. So it's actually highly selfish for them to be silent, but bad for their fellow victims or holders of minority views and perspectives. This is all a result of direct criticism not currently being PC. Interestingly, it is this frowning upon of anything critical that in my opinion leads to our current state of arrogance overall, and it is another reason why people like Dennis tend to praise stuff that is actually poor. You see, we all walk around with contradictory beliefs without receiving any substantive criticism. Without much criticism from others, we don't get to know very much about what we don't know as compared to a hypothetical world in which criticism left parenthesis including all forms colon nice, terse, etc. Right parenthesis was more welcomed. As a result, people think that they are more right about what they think than they actually are and succumb to groupthink while their critical thinking abilities plummet. They have little empathy or ability to really listen to anything that is different from what they already think and, worse, know to be true. This part isn't new. It is called the confirmation bias. Hyperlink to Wikipedia confirmation underscore bias excerpt follows colon confirmation bias from Wikipedia, the free encyclopedia. Confirmation bias, also called miside bias, is the tendency to search for, interpret, or recall information in a way that confirms one's beliefs or hypotheses. Note 1. 1. It is a type of cognitive bias and a systematic error of inductive reasoning. People display this bias when they gather or remember information selectively, or when they interpret it in a biased way. The effect is stronger for emotionally charged issues and for deeply entrenched beliefs. People also tend to interpret ambiguous evidence as supporting their existing position. Biased search, interpretation and memory have been invoked to explain attitude polarization left parenthesis when a disagreement becomes more extreme even though the different parties are exposed to the same evidence right parenthesis, belief perseverance left parenthesis when beliefs persist after the evidence for them is shown to be false right parenthesis. The irrational primacy effect left parenthesis a greater reliance on information encountered early in a series right parenthesis and illusory correlation left parenthesis when people falsely perceive an association between two events or situations right parenthesis. A series of experiments in the 1960s suggested that people are biased toward confirming their existing beliefs. Later work reinterpreted these results as a tendency to test ideas in a one-sided way, focusing on one possibility and ignoring alternatives. In certain situations, this tendency can bias people's conclusions. Explanations for the observed biases include wishful thinking and the limited human capacity to process information. Another explanation is that people show confirmation bias because they are weighing up the costs of being wrong, rather than investigating in a neutral, scientific way. Confirmation biases contribute to overconfidence in personal beliefs and can maintain or strengthen beliefs in the face of contrary evidence. Poor decisions due to these biases have been found in political and organizational contexts. Wikipedia excerpt done. A comment about Wikipedia article. Left parenthesis note that the word arrogance is not there. That word is probably viewed as being too critical and direct, so they have to use overconfidence, which is the same thing in my opinion. Right parenthesis many people think with certainty that their favored politician slash god slash pundit slash leader slash friend slash spouse is the one and only true one. They won't ask the tough criticizing questions. They won't even support those who do. Such messengers are shot at all levels. So those in power can get away with doing whatever they want without much fear. Link to a Facebook post by me about Carl Sagan. The post starts out by reverse logic. This video is a blueprint for taking over the world: just make sure critical thought is unpopular, and steer the politicians away from science. The post then links to a video called Carl Sagan and Government Charlie Rose. Here is the audio from that video.
My feeling, Charlie, is that it's not that pseudoscience and superstition and New Age so-called beliefs and fundamentalist zealotry are something new. They've been with us for as long as we've been human. But we live in an age based on science and technology with formidable technological powers.
Science and technology are propelling us forward at accelerating rates.
That's right. And if we don't understand it, by we I mean the general public, if it's something that, I'm not good at that, I don't know anything about it, then who is making all the decisions about science and technology that are going to determine what kind of future our children live in? Just some members of Congress? But there's no more than a handful of members of Congress with any background in science at all. And the Republican Congress has just abolished its own Office of Technology Assessment, the organization that gave them bipartisan, competent advice on science and technology. They say, we don't want to know. Don't tell us about science
Surprising.
And technology.
Surprising. The danger of all this. I mean, you know, this is not the thing that...
There's two kinds of dangers. One is what I just talked about, that we've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology. And this combustible mixture of ignorance and power, sooner or later, is going to blow up in our faces. I mean, who is running the science and technology in a democracy if the people don't know anything about it? And the second reason that I'm worried about this is that science is more than a body of knowledge. It's a way of thinking, a way of skeptically interrogating the universe with a fine understanding of human fallibility. If we are not able to ask skeptical questions, to interrogate those who tell us that something is true, to be skeptical of those in authority, then we're up for grabs for the next charlatan, political or religious, who comes ambling along. It's a thing that Jefferson laid great stress on. It wasn't enough, he said, to enshrine some rights in a constitution or a bill of rights. The people had to be educated, and they had to practice their skepticism and their education. Otherwise, we don't run the government. The government runs us.
As a result, on the macro level we have become witch hunters viewing violence and war as a superior alternative to intellectual debate and fair compromise. Related to being nice and the confirmation bias is what I call pleasure filtering, whereby one's need to be loved causes them to view things that make them feel good as more likely to be correct and things that makes them feel bad as more likely to be incorrect. This seems innocent enough. A good fraction of the reviews of non-fiction books on Amazon.com directly reveal this filter in that the reason they gave a good or bad review is respectively because the reader enjoyed or did not enjoy reading the book. What's wrong with that? Let's first look at the pleasure filter on microscopic level involving one person, then two, and then three people. Then, once we understand what it does, I will try to show what it does on a larger scale to large groups of people and ultimately entire countries. Zooming to the individual level at how the pleasure filter, the niceness filter, affects thought on an individual basis, consider a stereotypical girl subjected to math/science for the first time. Since it is new, it should make her feel dumb. This is normal for boys as well. At any rate, instead of learning the subject, she might just decide to take the easy way out, to use the pleasure filter. She can simply deem those subjects to be useless and stupid. And with this popular filter, a person who says anything negative about anything is, themselves, inherently bad, and their ideas can be dismissed purely on that basis. Per this filter, humor, which directly gives pleasure, may be the primary cause of the Dr. Fox effect. I have here a hyperlink to a Wikipedia article on the so-called Dr. Fox effect. A short excerpt follows. Dr. Fox effect from Wikipedia, the free encyclopedia. The Dr. Fox effect is a correlation observed between teacher expressiveness, content coverage, student evaluation and student achievement. This effect also allows insight to other related effects, such as those discussed below, and relationships between student achievement and evaluations of the teacher. Experiment. The original experiment was conducted at the University of Southern California School of Medicine in 1970, in which two speakers gave lectures to a classroom of MDs and PhDs psychiatrists and psychologists on an irrelevant topic. The topic, quote, mathematical game theory as applied to physician education, unquote, was chosen to eliminate the factor that the students being lectured may know information about the actual subject. Students were divided into two separate classrooms. One classroom would be lectured by an actual scientist and the other by an actor who was given the identity, quote, Dr. Myrnell Fox, unquote, a graduate of Albert Einstein College of Medicine. In the first half of the study, the actor was instructed to teach his material in a more monotoned and inexpressive voice. This lecture was then compared to the control lecture by the scientist. After the lectures, the students were tested on the information they had learned, and the students who attended the lecture taught by the scientist learned more about the material, and performed better on the examination. However, when both Dr. Myrnell Fox and the scientist both presented their material in an engaging, expressive, and enthusiastic manner, the students rated Dr. Fox just as highly as the genuine professor. This lack of correlation between content coverage and ratings under conditions of high expressiveness became known as the Dr. Fox effect. 2. In a critique of student evaluations of teaching, Professor of Law Deborah Merritt summarized the Dr. Fox effect as it was observed in the first experiments. The experimenters created a meaningless lecture on mathematical game theory as applied to physician education, and coached the actor to deliver it with an excessive use of double talk, neologisms, non-sequiturs, and contradictory statements. At the same time, the researchers encouraged the actor to adopt a lively demeanor, convey warmth toward his audience, and intersperse his nonsensical comments with humor. The actor fooled not just one, but three separate audiences of professional and graduate students. Despite the emptiness of his lecture, 55 psychiatrists, psychologists, educators, graduate students, and other professionals produced evaluations of Dr. Fox that were overwhelmingly positive. The disturbing feature of the Dr. Fox study, as the experimenters noted, is that Fox's nonverbal behaviors so completely masked a meaningless, jargon-filled, and confused presentation. 3. A 1980 study found that prestige of research could even be increased by confounding writing style, with research competency being positively correlated to reading difficulty. 4. That concludes the excerpt of the Wikipedia article about the Dr. Fox effect. Now back to your regularly scheduled programming. We can see from this example of the girl that people's need for love thus causes them to remove, from their lives, those that disagree with them. Also, she never learns math. Now consider two people. Assume they are inherently equally polite and nice. The first person thinks it is true and the other thinks it is false. The pleasure filter automatically makes these two people, to some extent, appear meaner to each other than if they really agreed about A. Yes, they could avoid talking about topic A since they disagree about it. But how did they learn they disagreed? They have to talk about it to know. So let's include the harm to the friendship in needing to avoid topic A as a sort of difficulty and extra effort it takes for them to be as nice to each other had they agreed. This is because disagreement is inherently a negative to those who subscribe to pleasure filtering. Left parenthesis, it isn't as much an opportunity to learn. It becomes a negative due to the pleasure filter. Right parenthesis. Without the pleasure filter, these two people could have freely discussed issue A. Person 1 might have convinced person 2 that he is wrong about something. Person 2 might realize that he perhaps feels a certain way, and that was his starting point. Upon further analysis, he might question that feeling. He might realize he feels that way because of how he was raised. Then person 1 might have asked him to reconsider that feeling on the basis that their parents were wrong as well. Perhaps person 2 might have changed his mind, and an agreement and stronger long-term friendship might have been more possible. The pleasure filter helped stop that. Now what if a third person comes along who is equally polite and nice? Pretend person 3 also happens to think that it is false. This implies that persons 2 and 3 agree, but now the first person is the odd man out, so to speak. Person 1 now seems to be the least nice of the bunch. However, this is to some extent an illusion due purely to pleasure filtering. Remember, all are equally nice. It is just that person 1 disagrees with persons 2 and 3. This paradox that someone is equally nice yet is not as nice is due to the irrationality of the pleasure filter. Now let's apply these principles to the masses. The first person becomes a minority. If we add in a few more people, it is obvious that the pleasure filter will eventually cause two groups, one which thinks it is correct and one which thinks it is incorrect. Also, each group will think the other group is not as nice. We see that the pleasure filter makes whatever the world or local group of people happens to think determine who seems nice and who seems less nice or even bad. Let's get more specific about this. For reasons too complex to discuss here, it is unlikely that these two groups disagreeing about A would be the same size. So one group would be bigger usually and one smaller. Let's talk about the smaller group. Due to them overcoming a bias, this small group should or at least could be made up of more profound and/or more independent thinkers. They will inherently be viewed by the bigger group, or society as a whole, as being less nice than they would be if they really agreed with the majority, other things staying the same. Simply put, the pleasure filter makes those who follow the herd appear nicer than they inherently are, and it makes independent thinkers appear meaner than they really are. This is very ironic. Why? Because the bigger group is really the meaner of the two, since it is only they could easily be bullying the smaller minority group, and bullying is generally thought of as being mean. Again, all this hold true assuming the independent thinkers are equally polite, aside from the basic fact that they happen to disagree with the bigger group. That itself does not appear to wrong until one considers how vastly different and self-contradictory mankind's belief systems have been since antiquity over this planet. Putting this in reverse gear, one quickly sees that an easy way to appear nice without doing any real work in a world using the pleasure filter, including this one, is to avoid doing any independent thinking altogether. In this comment, I will eventually get around to proving this notion that if rational thought has any value, the pleasure filter is inherently irrational. However, I think that this is just too incompatible with most people's view of what they know for a fact must be true. In other words, most people probably don't feel this could be possible. Therefore, for now, I merely will suggest and discuss the notion that the pleasure filter is not a reliable indicator of what is correct, that it is arrogant, and that it enables war. To recap, the pleasure filter essentially causes the population to be segregated into opposing parties/groups. They can pretend not to be cults, but in a sense they are similar. These larger self-empowered groups are fully capable of directly attacking the opposing groups. The large group ironically becomes an environment of hatred, in this case for those who are different. Thus, niceness leads to hatred. Due to the popularity of the pleasure filter, each such group is incapable of having any real empathy towards the other opposing groups. Why? Because we act on the individual incentive. There, anyone with such empathy would be exposed and ousted as a hypocrite by the group's cheerleaders. Worse, the members of the groups must, over time, suppress their own anti-group thoughts their own voices of reason in order to obtain the love from their groups they so desperately want. All this is to say that being nice leads to cults. So, if you like cults, just be nice, and you are in like Flynn. So this global need to be nice allows groups to form, exist, and hate each other. Let's talk more about this hate. Hatred is the epitome of being emotional. Emotions are really a time-saving mechanism. In my opinion, they are the same as feelings. Instead of remembering all one's experiences and past decisions, we sort of summarize them with emotions, the unexpressed root of our espoused logic that is supplied upon a query from someone. These past results, state variables, and hormonal conditions are utilized to move forward in our thinking about new situations, but the excessive value we place on these past results can be a source of arrogance. Thus, emotional thinking is arrogant, since one is unwilling to call into question the real bases of their decisions and opinions. But emotions are not all bad. They actually support rational thought. You see, it can be shown that emotions/feelings are acquired for consciousness. Taylor 1986. Does that seem paradoxical? Did I show that rational thought requires irrationality? The resolution of this paradox is to realize that what forms the basis for irrational thought is when a thinker is unwilling to unravel the basis for why they have feelings they relied upon. It is when they are unwilling to reconsider them even when presented with evidence or argument that their feelings may be unjustified. They stop all penetration into their analysis that would call into question their feelings. Subconsciously, they may be biased towards a logical alternative that doesn't touch their foundation, their feelings, their older axioms known since they a child. That is what a feeling is in the first place. It is just something that is not easily justified since it summarizes prior results, although it can also be injected to a neural net extrinsically. If good logic is available, rationality is the extent to which feelings are vulnerable and subject to the force of reason. Conversely, the extent to which feelings interfere with rational thought is irrationality. It is the untouchable biases going into the final decisions about what people say and do. From this perspective, the pleasure filter is an arrogant means of saving time, but only in the short run, since the groups could be wrong on an absolute level. Indeed, the SL mindset I have described in detail elsewhere directly gives society the pleasure filter, since it favors short-term pleasure. Thus, what we see is that the pleasure filter allows irrational, arrogant, and emotional groups to form. Those groups comprise people bursting with hatred towards those not in their groups and with love for those in their groups. Since people mostly only spend time within their groups, they get more love, but only on the short term. So who is to blame for this and how does it happen? I will only answer the latter here. It is etiquette that enforces this global stigma against criticism. It is finger pointing. When two people of different views meet, and one of them expresses a rational reason for why they disagree, the other person is all but programmed to classify that person as being not being nice, and to therefore terminate communication on that basis. He or she will say to themselves that this other person is a jerk, and doesn't know a thing about tact or etiquette. Yes, the topic is also a painful area to be avoided, but other communications from this person, even pleasant topics, will also be ignored henceforth, since, otherwise they would be friends of a jerk. As such they could lose their own friends who give them the pleasure of camaraderie. These terminations further solidify the pre-existing emotions via the desire for people to be right about their past decisions. Those emotions, which are the true basis for the disagreements between groups, will become even more resilient to change. This is again because emotions are the inexpressible reasons for why people think the way they do. They are the hidden iceberg holding up the visible and supplied rationale. In the example above about how the two people might have agreed about it if they were not so nice, what they would really have been doing is going back and to surrender their feelings, lifting more of the iceberg out of the water. The non-nice thought process could have been rational because the common ground in the discussion, the common feelings about stuff, could have become the new starting point. On the other hand, being nice prevents the important, different, and hidden emotional basis of rational thought to be placed upon the cutting board and to be altered. It prevents change and meaningful discussion, since the discussion must now alter to be PC and nice left parenthesis that is non-emotional right parenthesis and therefore somewhat fake. Niceness, or really the negative reaction from normal people to critics, doesn't lubricate meaningful discussion, it actually prevents it. It places blame upon the diplomat slash messenger instead of where it really belongs, which is at those who were offended. Those following Judith Martin left parenthesis also known as Ms. Manners right parenthesis. They are the finger pointers, who, after leaving a dinner party, tried to get credit for noting the rudeness of anyone who might have crossed that Rubicon separating the glorified paper tigers and the deep, submerged, and entrenched emotional beliefs that matter much more. Eliminating the taboo and emotional conversation items from the dinner table merely allows existing views to remain unchanged. We all salute the official heroes. Yet we are hypocrites. Few recall that those same heroes were being viewed as jerks when they did whatever made them famous. The average dinner table conversation is thus neutered and vanillified. It is like the fakeness of the changing of the guards at Buckingham Palace. Paper tigers are publicly exchanged in a waste of time as the inner feelings causing the most important differences remain totally intact. This is why deep discussions about religion or politics are essentially off-limits to all but the HLs, unless people by accident notice that they already agree. As long as conversations must be non-emotional, they can't get to the core of the average SL thought process. Yes. This is profound exclamation mark. I'm saying war is a result of our notion that criticism is generally bad and should be so strongly curtailed exclamation mark. Basically, this view that any sort of name-calling is itself the crime is a big part of the reason that conflicts and disagreements can persist. The pleasure filter actually enables the worst of evils to exist and thrive, for if a group one is a member of is doing anything really bad, This filter can yet again be invoked as an excuse to shield most members from their group's worst deeds. Only the top people in the GOP knew and approved of Watergate. The rest only learned about it accidentally. Our society can thus freely celebrate Veterans Day while simultaneously hiding from view the bodies of the enemies we have blown up. Similarly, on a microscopic level, too many people tend to bite their tongues, storing stuff in their oversized metaphorical backpacks, secretly feeling even more discomfort, pain, and negatively inside instead of releasing their true opinions and wants calmly, directly, honestly, and in real time with better efficiency. When their backpacks of truth finally explode, the reality clash isn't very constructive. That's why those pimping the strongest anti-criticism memes here on Facebook are actually often the least happy inside. When, to be popular, we have to self-censor and psicize our every word, thought, and statement about anything important such that our true ideas are only obtainable upon reading implied innuendo between the lines, when the only topics discussed here honestly are about food, babies, and pets, when every tooth of every important thought or point is extracted or watered down before it can be released, well, it yields the worst things plaguing our societies, such as unhappiness, anxiety, depression, and addiction. Instead of facing our problems, many people smart enough to be aware of them escape into antidepressants, TV, books, and movies to see worlds which really don't exist but they wish did. But arrogance does far more than cause distantors and unhappiness. I've explained my perspectives in more detail elsewhere. Left parenthesis C. For example, comments on links in hyperlink to a Facebook post that says here is why non-scientists are arrogant. The post shows a picture that quotes Carl Sagan saying in Science It Often Happens That Scientists Say, you know that's a really good argument, my position is mistaken, and then they actually change their minds and you never hear that old view from them again. They really do it. It doesn't happen as often as it should, because scientists are human and change is sometimes painful. But it happens every day. I cannot recall the last time something like that happened in politics or religion. Carl Sagan, 1987 Xicop keynote address, then I have another hyperlink. It was a very long comment about addiction and how to stop addiction. It suggests that the drug users are arrogant to think they can take just this one hit and quit later. It also made a case that the entire drug culture helped prevent the Vietnam War from being terminated because drug users are perhaps less likely to protest about anything abstract like distant wars, and noted that anti-drug laws came into place around the same time that the Vietnam War ended. However, the entire thread was deleted by the person who had posted the parent post, and it was a friends-only post, so strangers would not have been able to read it anyway. Right parenthesis now back to the my anti-war main text. In short, much of my life I've dealt with people who think they understand stuff but don't really. From auto mechanics who randomly replace parts instead of fixing any of them. To doctors operating on patients with a poor diet. I know someone who was given a prescription for cough medication. By the time she finally saw a less arrogant doctor, several months later, she was diagnosed with cancer. The cough was from a tumor near her lung which had grown to 22 centimeters in length. Two politicians waging wars because they think they know stuff they don't. Left parenthesis Vietnam lasted so long due to bad intel. Iraq was for WMDs that didn't exist. Etc. Right parenthesis to economists thinking they have a clue how the Fed works and that they have the best answers. To people who think they fully understand a complex movie with subtle memes just because they saw it. To someone who thinks they know the truth about some news story just because they read an article about it. Left parenthesis has a news outlet ever said that a prior story was not actually completely true, that a fact was wrong? Why, never, The official story about MH370 has never changed one bit! Exclamation mark. Yes, I just .write parenthesis. Just the other day a top scholar had the arrogance to tell me something was impossible to do. Well, I quickly invented a brand new solution on the spot, proving him wrong. In my opinion, even the notion that we aren't arrogant as a species is strong proof of it. The use of mechanics perspective seems gray to the average Joe. But, now that I've explained my views, one might be able to see I think it is the same sort of mentality that tends to lead to engine failure, explosions, disasters, etc. And I might add that his past employer, and the military-industrial complex at large, whose breadth and depth of influence I in my limited abilities and own personal experiences seem unable to fully comprehend the limits, if any of, would not welcome distribution of my message. They can't even admit their failures. That they have become inept due to their arrogance. The team led by Kelly Johnson, which created the SR-71, could probably never even exist in today's groupthink world in which criticism is deemed wrong. Left parenthesis hyperlink to a documentary about the SR-71. Parcel audio follows.
The Facebook post about the correlation between war and being nice links to a YouTube video at this point on the SR-71, and it doesn't just link to the whole video, it links to a specific section. Before I play it, let me set it up for you. The person is like an old employee of the person who bought us the SR-71 Blackbird. He's discussing the past employee of the boss. He is discussing the way that management was done by this person. The guy's name, the manager's name, the person who basically brought us the SR-71, his name is Kelly, or was Kelly. So he's discussing it, and the thing I want to bring forward, or the thing I decided to talk about later in this Facebook post about war, and originally about this plane as well, was just that this kind of management style probably would not be acceptable in today's very politically correct world, because it allowed for conflict that really isn't allowable now, and in my opinion. So you can hear for yourself and decide for yourself what you think, but here's the short clip, and this is from an entire one-hour documentary. It's sort of interesting. I'll probably include it as well, but after you're done, you'll note that I rewind to the beginning, and you can just, when you note it goes back to the beginning. I would fast forward by exactly an hour. I think it's an hour long, if you're not interested in this particular plane. And then you'll hear the same audio again, although it's only a short clip, really. So here's both the clip and then the 1 hour or so long video.
Kelly, when you had a problem, he'd have a meeting, and decisions were made right then. He was always very fair. He could be very tough. He was no pussycat, I'll tell you.
Faster than a speeding bullet, and unlike any other aircraft ever built, it raced the sun and won. Flying at speeds of 2,000 miles an hour, in the top 1% of the Earth's atmosphere, it holds every major speed and altitude record for a jet.
You did all of this effortlessly, and that was the feeling you had, that you had control of so much power.
It was the world's first stealth aircraft, flying over enemy territory and photographing 100,000 square miles of the Earth's surface in an hour.
You were sitting at the very front of that 107-foot-long spear penetrating enemy airspace. You were truly the tip of the sword. If anything went wrong, we would be on the 6 o'clock news.
Once shrouded in secrecy, Battle Stations now reveals, using archive film and color reenactments, the covert world of the SR-71 Blackbird. During World War I, the first reconnaissance aircraft were developed to photograph the enemy in an attempt to gain a tactical advantage. World War II saw more sophisticated aircraft and camera technology that played a vital role in the Allied victory. After the Second World War, the world was left with two ideologically opposed superpowers. The Cold War had begun, and the United States wanted to keep a watchful eye on events behind the Iron Curtain. America was desperate for information about Soviet nuclear stockpiling, fighter capability, and bomber threat. In early December 1954, operating to the direct approval of President Eisenhower, the task of creating the next generation of reconnaissance aircraft was assigned to the visionary designer Kelly Johnson and his elite team from Lockheed's Advanced Development Program, known as the Skunk Works.
I think Kelly's operation of the Skunk Works was probably unique in the aviation industry. To start with, he had a very, very small cadre of people. He handpicked everyone that worked for him. They were swore to ultimate secrecy. There was absolutely no leaks within the system. He was guaranteed of that. He also made it a point to co-locate his engineers and his producers, the people who were building the airplane, so the engineer could come up with a drawing and he would walk out on the hangar floor and talk to the man who's bending metal.
I can't stress enough the engineers directly with the shop people all the time. And Kelly, when you had a problem, you'd have a meeting and decisions were made right then. He was always very fair. He could be very tough. He was no pussycat, I'll tell you.
Kelly's Skunk Works produced their first spy plane in 1955, the U-2. In an effort to evade Soviet radar, the U-2 was designed to fly at an altitude of 75,000 feet. In 1956, it began overflying the Soviet Union on reconnaissance missions. But the Soviets' latest radar systems were more advanced than had been anticipated.
When the U-2 flown by the CIA first began their operations over the Soviet Union, they were shocked to discover that the Soviets were tracking them, even on the very first mission. And so it became obvious that the U-2, despite its altitude, which was to be the saving grace for the aircraft, that it would be too high for Soviet radar to be tracking. It turns out they had better radar than we thought they had.
The Soviets protested at this continual violation of their airspace, but Eisenhower repeatedly denied the existence of an American spy plane. Every U-2 flown over the Soviet Union was in serious danger.
The U-2 was being tracked, and that was a great concern to not only to our country, but to Lockheed, who had promised that this airplane would never be seen.
Determined to create the ultimate spy plane, Kelly Johnson returned to the drawing board. He began designing a new supersonic aircraft that could fly faster and higher than the U-2 with the lowest possible presence on enemy radar screens. Then, on the 1st of May 1960, disaster struck. A U-2 flown by Francis Gary Powers was shot down by an SA-2 missile, playing right into the hands of Soviet propaganda.
In Moscow, Nikita Khrushchev is shown as he told the Soviet Presidium that pilot Gary Powers of the downed American reconnaissance plane was alive, and that Russia had seized spy photographs made 1,400 miles inside Soviet borders. And Mr. K was quick to play on the incident for propaganda advantage.
Powers had a very public trial, designed to humiliate the U.S. and deter them from carrying out any further reconnaissance flights. But with tensions between the superpowers mounting, the need for reconnaissance was more urgent than ever. Kelly Johnson's plans for an advanced supersonic spy plane became the number one priority. In order to create an aircraft capable of operating at the speeds and altitudes that Kelly envisaged, his Skunkworks team would have to overcome a series of huge technological problems.
The biggest problem that he was going to face, and he knew this up front, was going to be temperature. The temperatures that the aircraft would encounter at those speeds, phenomenal.
It was clear that a traditional aluminium airframe would not withstand these extreme conditions.
You could not fly an airplane past 2.6 Mach, and you just barely make it then with aluminum, because the airplane had just turned to jelly.
The decision was made to build the airframe from titanium. Titanium was both light enough to reach altitudes in excess of 80,000 feet and strong enough to withstand the enormous temperatures generated by Mach 3 flight.
No one had ever built an airplane out of titanium, so he had to begin from scratch. We didn't even have tools that you could use to develop titanium and to bend it and to shape it and to make an airplane. So we had to start by designing tools. It was a gigantic undertaking.
Creating an aircraft able to cruise at Mach 3 was difficult enough, but the Skunkworks also had to face the challenge of combining this level of performance with the new science of stealth. To avoid features that would create strong radar reflections, the plane had taken on a revolutionary shape. The wings were blended into the body, and the long surfaces on the forward fuselage, known as chines, were designed to deflect incoming radar waves. As were the inward-angled twin fins, the pointed engine cones, and the nearly flat lower fuselage. Also, a special radar-absorbent plastic, or composite, was developed to be incorporated into all the leading edges.
When you look at an SR-71, 20% of what you see is composite. You know, it's just unbelievable at that time. And it was developed in our shops. An SR-71 was 100 times smaller radar return than an F-14, which is only half as big and was developed 10 years later. So that was a really, truly first airplane specifically designed with stealth in mind.
The development of the SR-71 was being carried out under conditions of utmost secrecy. But then, on the 24th of July 1964, to the amazement of the Skunkworks team, President Lyndon B. Johnson revealed to the world that America had created an advanced new spy plane.
I think everybody was surprised when President Johnson made the announcement. I know the military was certainly surprised because it was supposed to have been a secret airplane. It was a political ploy. He was grasping for some boosts in his ratings, and so he elected to make the announcement when, in fact, everybody was trying to keep wraps on the project.
On the 22nd of December 1964, the SR-71 was rolled out onto the flight line at Lockheed's Burbank plant. Coated in black, radar-absorbent ferrite paint, the Blackbird, as it became known, was an extraordinarily futuristic-looking machine. Lockheed test pilot Robert Gilliland would be the first in the cockpit.
When we got going, as a matter of fact, for the actual first flight, it had 383 open items. These are things that are supposed to be working that aren't working. So it was a bare-bones type of operation for the first flight. And you might say these kind of things could be dangerous, but there are plenty of other people that would like to have been in my position, I assure you of that.
The acceleration when we made the first engine run, and they had those afterburners going in there, and that thing is straining against those cables, and I just felt, boy, this is really going to be something.
The flight lasted just over 1 hour, reaching top speeds of over 1,000 miles an hour. A phenomenal accomplishment for a first flight of any aircraft.
Kelly Johnson was there and some of his guests were there, and I don't remember who all else was there, but the whole kit and caboodle were very happy, including me.
It seemed that Kelly had created his ultimate spy plane. But would it be able to evade radar and fly high enough and fast enough to escape the Soviet fighters and missiles? Flying at speeds in excess of Mach 3, at altitudes over 80,000 feet, the SR-71 Blackbird was the fastest and highest flying jet in the world. In 1966, the first SR-71 spy plane was delivered to Beale Air Force Base in California. The first strategic reconnaissance squadron now needed an elite force of airmen to fly it.
They went to two sources to gather their crew members. The first primary source was the B-58 Hustler supersonic bomber, and they selected several crews from that source. And then they went to the U-2 program, and they picked 10 of us from the U-2 program to come up to Beale Air Force Base in California and form the first squadron.
Well, my first thought was, I sure hope that I'm selected for the program. I mean, that was ultimate, to get selected for the program.
In order to qualify for the SR-71, you had to be very good at what you were doing thus far in your aviation career. In fact, you had to be pretty much the best at what you did to be considered as a candidate.
Each Blackbird needed two crew members, the pilot and the RSO, the reconnaissance systems officer.
It was extremely exciting to just to get signed into Beale Air Force Base and to think that you're going to be flying this airplane. You cannot wait.
But the selection interviews and evaluations alone lasted a week and included a rigorous physical examination, the same as experienced by the astronaut corps.
Now, the first 2 days were physicals, an astronaut physical in a sense, taking an EKG on a treadmill and full body x-rays, just very extensive physical exam. They also wanted to know if you were the kind of person that they could live with on the road, because you had to spend a lot of time together. You know, in a sense, it's part of your family. And they wanted to evaluate people to see if they'd be a good member of that family.
The pilot began his actual training with long hours in T-38s and in the SR-71 simulator. The intense simulator sessions tested the crew members to their limits.
They basically made it a grueling experience. They would just give me multiple malfunctions to deal with. In fact, they just keep giving you another problem on top of another problem until you're juggling 5 or 6 or 7 balls at once, and eventually you have to start dropping them. And they would evaluate how you prioritized which ball do you drop.
After months of training, the crews were ready for their first flight together. The extreme speed and altitude called for special protection, and this came in the shape of the $120,000 pressure suit.
Two technicians suit you up. You step down into it, you put your arms into it, and it comes up to your back. The boots are separate from the suit, and they're just regular, real combat boots. The gloves are especially handmade for you, and they snap on with little O-rings onto your suit. Then when you put the helmet on, it's quite heavy, and once they snap it down, you hear yourself breathing. For a few moments there, you get some claustrophobia. I did anyway.
The suit was designed to have 100% oxygen in the nasal cavity area and then compressed air in the rest of the suit, so that if you were to lose cabin pressure at 80,000 feet or above, the nitrogen bubbles in your system would come out and your blood would boil. So you need some kind of an environment around you. That's what the pressure suit provided.
Suited up, the pilot and RSO are ready to be escorted out to the aircraft for their first flight together.
There are three people that do nothing but strap you into the cockpit. And unlike a lot of aircraft, this cockpit is down sort of in the bowels of the aircraft. You get placed down inside the cockpit and strapped in. And then the canopy is lowered on top of you. You don't even lower it yourself. Someone has to do that for you and lock it down. You're kind of becoming part of the aircraft, and it's becoming part of you.
A shot of triethyl borane gas ignites the fuel, and the J-58 engines are started.
Where it really got impressive is when it starts taxiing out of the hangar. And it's 110 feet long, and so this thing keeps coming out, keeps coming out, keeps coming out. And all of a sudden, you realize that's an awesome-looking airplane as it gradually comes out of the hangar.
So here we were looking at an airplane that was going to be going 2,000 miles an hour, and its design was so futuristic. It was like no other airplane that had ever been designed, because it was going to fly in an environment that no other airplane had ever been in.
Tower Aspen 30 is number one for takeoff.
I'll never forget how it feels to light those afterburners and feel one light before the other one does, and it jerks you pretty hard.
Next thrust.
And it accelerates rather rapidly. Just a matter of seconds, you're hitting 180 knots indicated airspeed, lifting off at 210, making sure you get the gear retracted before it overspeeds at 300 knots, and you keep pulling that nose up to try to achieve the 400-knot climb out. And in less than 2 minutes from brake release, you're pulling out of afterburn, you're level at 24,000 feet. It's quite a ride.
I remember the first time I took the aircraft up to speed and into altitude, I went through Mach 1. And then I approached Mach 2, and it went through Mach 2 without the slightest indication of any problems, and I marveled at that. And then it rolled right on through Mach 3. Of course, none of us had ever been that fast before, but you did all of this effortlessly. And that was the feeling you had, that you had control of so much power on this aircraft that it was almost limitless.
As the SR-71 accelerates through Mach 3, the triple sonic boom is followed by a blast of heat radiating from its black skin that reaches temperatures of 1,100 degrees.
It truly flew through the air like a hot knife through butter. It really did. So it was pointy on every end, but it had elegance. But it was an elegance that was designed for performance.
After 10 months of grueling training, the SR-71 crews were ready to go operational. Flying over heavily defended areas in enemy territories would push both the aircraft and the crews to their limits. On March the 21st, 1968, the first SR-71 operational sortie was flown out of Kadena Air Force Base, Okinawa, Japan. The Vietnam War had been raging for 5 years, and the United States was determined to contain and defeat communism in Southeast Asia. The role of the SR-71 would be to gather photographic and electronic intelligence of their enemies. They would fly daily over territories where one mistake could cost the lives of the crew and provoke an international incident.
In this program, the margin for error was so narrow, almost to nothing, that it really was the pressure of flying the mission flawlessly, so that because if anything went wrong, we would be on the 6 o'clock news.
SR-71 missions were always carefully planned. In their briefing, the crews thoroughly study the mission route and surveillance areas and are warned of potential enemy threats.
Well, we tried to stay well informed about our adversaries' capabilities, about their ability to track our movement, our aircraft, any potential surface-to-air missiles that might be a threat to us, or any aircraft that might be a threat to us during a flight.
3 hours before the mission, they have a medical checkup and eat a high-protein meal of steak and eggs. The crew chief and his staff spend hours inspecting the SR-71 for any possible mechanical problems.
The pre-flight on the aircraft starts around midnight. We're saying for a 6 or 7 o'clock launch in the morning.
And there's a lot of procedures that you go through. Cameras have to be uploaded. The bays are in the forward section of the chines. And then the cameras was electrically lifted up into it. We always loaded a light load of fuel for the mere fact that it's a lot easier on the airframe, it's a lot easier on the tires, the landing gear, and so forth like that.
There was always excitement in the air, electrifying. Every time you fly the airplane, it was everybody was keyed up. Everybody did their job and did it extremely well. I took it very, very seriously.
Everybody worked together, and it was a team effort, and everybody knew that they was striving for that one thing, and it was perfection. The SR-71 demanded it because there was no room for error. When you get ready to launch the airplane there, things are happening so fast that you send the airplane off, and of course you're going to be concerned about whether or not it's going to come back. You're constantly thinking whether everything is correct or not, and those questions kind of creep into your mind.
Above 60,000 feet, the crew switches off all contact with air traffic control. Only a select few know where the Blackbird goes next.
The pilot in the SR-71 spent all of his time flying the airplane. The airplane operated on autopilot, that's true, but you had to kind of hand fly the autopilot. It demanded your attention all the time. And so the fellow in the back seat, the reconnaissance systems officer, he handled all of the auxiliary systems.
Sitting in the rear cockpit, the RSO must keep the plane on the black line, the pre-planned route to the target. As they reach enemy territory, he concentrates on the radar and defensive systems, trying to jam enemy communications in the event of a missile launch.
We carried the same type of jammer that was used throughout the Vietnam War by all of the fighters and bombers, which attempted to jam the communication between the radar site and the missile itself. Once they began the communication, our indications in the cockpit would go from warning to jamming, and it would be jamming that communication link to the missile.
But sometimes the enemy would try to attack the SR-71 by launching a missile without any radar guidance.
We were coming in off the water, headed inland, and the pilot says, "Hey, Reg, look out your right window, and here is what looks like a telephone pole about 150 yards away that's going just straight up." He said, "Was that close enough?" And I said, "Yeah, that was close enough."
Our main defense, if we were fired upon, was increased speed. And we could increase 100 knots, 200 knots in just a matter of seconds, which is a lot of differential in speed for a missile to cope with.
Approaching the target area, the RSO concentrates on operating the high-tech surveillance equipment. The six different cameras were able to photograph 100,000 square miles in an hour, producing images with such high resolution that a vehicle's number plate could be clearly identified.
The surveying capability of the aircraft was fantastic because you're going in a straight line for 2,000 miles. You could look out as far as the horizon goes, and from horizon to horizon, that's what you could survey.
For the crews flying in the top 1% of the atmosphere, it gave them a unique perspective on the world.
The first thing that you notice that's phenomenal is the change of the sky color. At about 60,000 feet, the sky turns a deep indigo steel blue that is so mesmerizing. You just want to look at it. It's fascinating.
You know, if I flew the aircraft up near the Arctic Circle, and I might actually traverse dawn to dusk and back two or three times. I've seen the sun rise and set three times on a flight, which is very unusual. I mean, we're actually flying faster than the Earth's rotation, so we're outrunning the sun.
Lockheed's SR-71 Blackbird was a unique flying machine that offered the United States awesome opportunities of surveillance over its enemies.
The role of the SR-71 is strictly reconnaissance. It's designed to fly when you want it to fly over heavily defended areas. We have satellites, but the satellite is very predictable. The SR-71 provides flexibility. They can be there any time, day or night.
When the SR-71 returned from a reconnaissance mission, the highest priority was to download the cameras, known as sensors, as quickly as possible.
Everyone was deeply concerned that their sensor performed as it was designed to do and programmed to do. So there was a lot of serious concern there, and there was a lot of happiness because the plane had made a successful mission and the crews were home.
The films were then rushed off for processing and analysis.
Well, the photo interpreters were a brilliant bunch of young airmen, and they could look at that film and they could spot something had been moved or a new facility was going up. They were great at that. And they would call their supervisors if they saw something of interest, you know, that needed to be flagged and brought to the attention of the intelligence people.
One of the things I enjoyed about flying the Blackbird was knowing that information is power. The information we would gather could very well preclude bombs having to be dropped at all. It could save a lot of people's lives by having the right information at the right time.
The Blackbird crews were successfully infiltrating enemy territory and gathering a mass of intelligence about their adversaries. But with the Iron Curtain still firmly in place and Soviet technology constantly improving, how long would the SR-71 remain flying safely in such dangerous areas? It would soon face the ultimate test. In the early 1970s, tension between America's ally Israel and her Arab neighbors was reaching breaking point. At a summit in June 1973, the Soviet leader Brezhnev warned Richard Nixon that America's strong pro-Israeli stance in the Middle East was making it difficult for the Soviets to hold back their Arab allies. On the 6th of October 1973, Soviet-backed Egypt and Syria attacked Israel and made dramatic territorial gains. With the Middle East caught up in the politics of the Cold War, an Israeli defeat would bring with it the threat of nuclear conflict. The Soviets had launched their Cosmos 596 satellite, bringing them immediate intelligence from the battlefronts and putting them one step ahead of the United States.
The State Department needed to know what was happening. We couldn't afford to take a satellite out of its orbit. There were priority missions in Russia. And the Russians had put up several satellites knowing what was happening there. They were supporting the Egyptians. We had promised to go ahead and support the Israelis, but we had no intelligence coming in at that particular time.
It was time to bring in the Blackbird. The SR-71 would fly directly from Griffiths Air Force Base, New York, to the Middle East. The flight would be over 11 hours long, with 6 refuelings. No Blackbird crew member had ever experienced such a lengthy, complex mission.
I flew a 10.5-hour training flight, and I was beat by the time I got out of the airplane. I said, whew, that's about as far as I can fly. But when they said you can fly 11 hours and 20 minutes, you jump up and you say, yes, sir, you know, I'll be happy to do that.
I picked Jim Shelton as the first pilot to fly the mission. I knew he was an extremely reliable, highly qualified, and had done extremely well in all of his training and everything. So I had total confidence that if the mission could be done, that Jim would do it.
On the 12th of October, under codename Giant Reach, the mission began.
We took off from Rome, New York, around 1 or 2 in the morning, because you want to be over a target area somewhere between 11 and 1 o'clock. This allows you to have some shadows so the photo interpreters can go ahead and judge elevation, but yet get you the best sun position you can have.
By 10 o'clock in the morning, the SR-71 had reached its second refueling point over Portugal. because of the highly classified nature of this mission, no one other than the tanker crew knew they were coming.
On the way into that particular refueling, the tanker crews said the Portuguese control kept calling out an airplane in relation to the tanker. And the tanker says, you know, we don't see anybody. Of course, they knew it was us. But I'm sure that they could tell on their scope something was happening because the two blips merged for a while, for 20 minutes, and then this one accelerates on.
Jim Shelton approached the Egyptian coastline. The Egyptians were well equipped, with their Soviet allies constantly replenishing their supplies.
Russia was developing the SA-5, which was a missile that would go up above, well above your altitude and come back down at you. And yes, that was a concern.
With 160 SAM missile sites, many secretly commanded by Soviets, and sophisticated radar tracking systems, they were on full-scale alert, watching the skies for any enemy infiltration.
As soon as we got into range of the Egyptian SAM sites, they started tracking us.
The Egyptians, alerted to an unidentified aircraft appearing on their radar systems, and presuming the plane to be either Israeli or American, scrambled to launch their surface-to-air missiles. 80,000 feet above them, traveling at a speed of over Mach 3, Jim Shelton's Blackbird was gathering thousands of feet of film, capturing the extent and whereabouts of the Egyptian military forces.
You had the radar receiver in the back cockpit. Gary could tell me that, yes, now we're being tracked by some SAM missile. We need to do something. So at that particular point, we would jam, we would speed up.
By the time the Egyptian missiles were ready to fire, the SR-71 had already cleared their airspace and was speeding towards Israel. But the heavily armed Israelis also had no knowledge of this covert Blackbird operation and immediately went on full alert.
When we rolled in on the first pass over Israel, my defensive system just lighted up like a pinball machine. And I indicated to my pilot, I got all these indications back here. I said, just, you know, maybe keep your eyes open because seems like somebody's shooting at us.
Despite launching a barrage of missiles, the Israelis did not manage to shoot their presumed enemy out of the sky. The Blackbird headed back to the United States.
We got everything we were tasked for, got the airplane back. And that's the first time airplane, the SR-71, had flown 11 hours and 20 minutes. After we land, the next couple of days, Gary and I get invited to the Pentagon. Admiral Moore, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, wanted to thank us for the work that we had done. And they showed us some photos.
The photographs were detailed enough to show how many Israeli tanks had been destroyed in the initial battles.
We were to go ahead and resupply the Israelis with some of their lost equipment. So the photo interpreters are counting the number of tanks that we would be replacing. So it was a very crucial point for the SR-71.
It was a very sensitive mission, and there was a lot of pressure to get that first one done. Jim and his backseater nailed them. He got all the targets, and everyone was absolutely elated.
Eight more successful Blackbird missions supplied detailed intelligence that the war was now turning in Israel's favor. With this information, the United States was able to broker an eventual ceasefire on the 24th of October.
I think the SR-71 contributed greatly to the resolution of that war. No one knew the airplane could fly that far and perform a mission like that and come back and hand the intelligence people the product.
The Blackbird was also a record breaker. On September the 13th, 1974, Kelly Johnson's SR-71 flew across seven time zones from London to Los Angeles in a race with the sun, taking just 3 hours, 47 minutes, and 39 seconds.
For the record-breaking flight, I was over at the FAA control center, and the controller, a huge screen, and he said, here's a 747 coming out of Phoenix.
and it'd go blip. Blip. It moved about half inch or quarter inch. He said, okay, get ready. Here comes the SR-71 out of Canada. And it goes, brrrt, and there goes my antenna, brrrt, there goes Idaho. and get ready, boom! And it almost blew us out of the way because he was right overhead. And he was starting to decel, but he managed to blow the windows out of Zsa Gabor's house in the Hollywood Hills.
In the same year, the Blackbird had flown a record-breaking flight from New York to London. 52 years earlier, Charles Lindbergh had flown approximately the same distance in 33 hours. The SR-71 made the flight in 1 hour, 55 minutes, and 42 seconds. But the SR-71 would soon be needed in a more serious capacity. Another Soviet-backed Middle Eastern enemy was on the warpath and was determined to humiliate the United States. There would be no better way than to shoot the SR-71 out of the sky. Tension between the United States and much of the Arab world continued. In 1972, the revolutionary leader of Libya, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, announced that he was giving aid to terrorist organizations in Europe and the Middle East. He issued repeated threats to America and indicated that those who crossed the Gulf of Sidra would be crossing a line of death. By the spring of 1986, worldwide terrorism had reached unprecedented levels. President Reagan's patience was wearing thin.
Gaddafi deserves to be treated as a pariah in the world community. We call on our friends in Western Europe and elsewhere to join with us in isolating him. If these steps do not end Gaddafi's terrorism, I promise you that further steps will be taken.
Then, on the 5th of April, 1986, a bomb exploded in a West Berlin disco. Among the 232 casualties, two American servicemen were killed. The United States found clear evidence that Libyan leader Colonel Gaddafi was behind the attack. At RAF Mildenhall in England, SR-71 pilot Brian Shule knew that they were on course for retaliation.
Now, we knew that something was going on because all of a sudden the Mildenhall base had an extra security arm of guards around it. Our BOQ living quarters had armed guards at the doors. Next thing you knew, every tanker in the Air Force practically was landing at Mildenhall. There were new airplanes on the ramp that you hadn't seen before. And it was no secret to every Brit aircraft spotter out there that there was something going on.
The British government gave permission for the United States to fly the missions from their bases in England. At 9:30 a.m. on the 14th of April, the SR-71 crew members were ordered to a top-secret briefing. They were informed that the 48th Tactical Fighter Wing at Lakenheath would be striking selected Libyan targets within hours.
When we heard the words, you know, this morning at 2 a.m., the F-111s are launching, we were a little surprised that, well, this is for real. It's happening.
The SR-71's job would be to record the results of the airstrikes against Tripoli and Benghazi. That night, the F-111s began their mission.
So when we're trying to sleep, in the middle of the night, you're awakened by the roar of F-111s taking off. Listening to that, it was quite serious at that time because we knew maybe some of those people wouldn't come back.
By the time the SR-71 crews arrived to prepare for their mission, the F-111s were already bombing Libya.
My fellow Americans, at 7 o'clock this evening, Eastern Time, air and naval forces of the United States launched a series of strikes against the headquarters, terrorist facilities, and military assets that support Muammar Gaddafi's subversive activities. Today, we have done what we had to do. If necessary,
we shall do it again.
The 111's had a number of targets to take out missile defenses, sites and things, but also all the terrorist training camps, and to really hit Gaddafi's headquarters, basically, to really show him that we're going to come right into his backyard. Our job was to come and assess everything that was done, gather pictures and target data for maybe succeeding strikes.
Flying in directly after a bombing raid, the crews could expect Libya's sophisticated air defense network to be on full alert and eager to retaliate.
We were subsonic off Land's End, getting ready to get to the tanker, and we saw the string of F-111s coming back. And my backseater, Walter, was counting the planes as they came back and passed us. And he came up one short, and he knew that somebody had not made it home. And we were very sad in the cockpit at that time before we even started that we had lost an entire crew. But yet, it gave us more resolve.
After refueling, and now traveling at supersonic speeds, they neared the Gulf of Sidra and the Libyan target area.
We're doing over 2,000 miles an hour at this point, and we were like a speeding bullet, except faster. And we had crossed the line of death with impunity.
But the Libyans, equipped with the latest Soviet long-range high-altitude missiles, posed the greatest threat yet to the Blackbird.
It was at that time that Walter started picking up some missile signals. He got two indications and then actually got a launch indication. And we had a big decision to make where we were running into the target area before we made the turn. Do we continue to that point where Gaddafi's headquarters were, or do we make a turn away now to save ourselves from the missiles? And our decision was to push the throttles forward. And we thought in 14 seconds we can beat that missile to that point and then make the turn. Made the turn, went feet wet, got to the coast, and I will tell you, that was probably the fastest I've ever seen the SR-71 fly.
They'd outrun the missile, gathered the photographic intelligence, and were now heading away from the danger zone.
Walt said, okay, you can pull it back now. My hand was still locked in the forward position there. We were seeing Mach numbers that were a little scary, that we had not seen before, and the jet did it effortlessly.
The intelligence photos that were brought back clearly showed that the bombing mission had been a success. It was decided there would be no need to risk more American airmen's lives over Libya with further bombing.
We brought back the confirmation of to whether we needed to go in again or not, what we had really done, where their defenses were, what they really had. But we made a statement to Gaddafi, and if you'll notice, you remember, you didn't hear a lot from him for a long time after that.
But despite the success of the SR-71s over Libya, its days were numbered. At the end of the 1980s, it was decided that the cost of operating the SR-71 was no longer sustainable. The Blackbird program was terminated. From now on, all American surveillance would be carried out by satellites.
The reason that was given was that it was too expensive. Well, it's reconnaissance. That's sometimes that can be very expensive. And if you don't have reconnaissance, you're pretty blinded. And now they like to say that the satellites can do it all. And satellites can do a great deal, and they're magnificent capabilities. But there are things they can't do, and there are things that are unique that only the SR-71 can do.
On December the 20th, 1989, the SR-71 made a final pass down the runway at Lockheed's Burbank plant in honor of all those who worked on this exceptional plane. Kelly Johnson was there to pay an emotional farewell to his favorite creation.
You can't say enough about Kelly Johnson himself. You know, he was an absolute aeronautical genius working for Lockheed. I think he's made the greatest aircraft that ever existed. There's just something about the sleek SR-71 that makes it in a class of one. There is no other.
Impressive to the last, the Blackbird set four international speed records while being delivered to the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum.
People love a winner. They love when someone is the best in their field. This aircraft was the best in its field. It was the prime speed machine of the world. Every speed and altitude record that it set, it holds to this day.
The SR-71 Blackbird served six different presidents and saw action on hot and cold war fronts alike. And despite being shot at over 4,000 times, no aircraft was ever lost to enemy fire.
It is the only operational airplane in the history of the American Air Force in which no Air Force crew members were ever killed. That's a record that no other airplane has. And when you consider the environment in which it flew, the speed, the altitude, the temperatures, that's a real credit to Kelly Johnson.
Back to my anti-war article. All attempts in the past 38 years at making a jet faster than Johnson's have failed. And, just as I predicted when they didn't follow my advice from 10 years ago, with insane budget overruns. A hyperlink to a video critical of a recent jet fight awry was opposed to an engineering decision on follows. It is about 10 minutes long.
The F-35 is the jet that ate the Pentagon. It's devouring the budget, and it's devouring the Pentagon's air capability.
What it looks like now is we're probably going to spend twice as much as we thought on the system. You're talking about $1.5 trillion.
$1.5 trillion for a plane that so far has not worked. At a time when they're cutting the budget for cops and teachers.
It's extraordinary, phenomenally expensive. And it's never been in combat.
The airplane is so complex and horrendously designed that we'll be lucky if we can fly it every other day.
It won't be ready for combat on the current schedule until about 2019, almost 10 years late.
The biggest beneficiary of the F-35 is Lockheed Martin.
War profiteering is a very easy source of money if you don't worry about what's right and wrong.
Lockheed Martin getting $36 billion a year of our tax money, and much of that rolls over into profit.
These people are being paid with our tax dollars because most of the money that these defense contractors bring in are taxpayer dollars through government contracts.
I think a lot of what the contractors do is basically legalize greed. The F-35 was sold as sort of this great bargain for the country.
The whole purpose behind F-35 was to develop a family and lower the total cost.
The idea was we could make the unit cost of this very inexpensive if we got all the services, the Air Force, the Navy, and the Marine Corps, to buy a version of the F-35.
We're very focused on giving the taxpayer and the Department of Defense very good value for a dollar that is spent.
But it's just this Rube Goldberg contraption where you've got all these complex things that you're trying to do building around the same airframe.
It tries to do all sorts of things, none of them well.
So there was this whole series of things that it could not do. So in that sense, it was probably the worst possible choice in terms of an affordable aircraft. But it's great for Lockheed Martin because they're going to have cost overruns. Because they're not ready. They don't work yet. And they're going to fix the things later at our expense. But they're already billing them in the hundreds.
Right from the start, Lockheed had a terrible program plan to make sure that the money flow would never get interrupted. And that was the idea of concurrent development.
Concurrency is a wonkish term for buying the airplane as you're developing it and purchasing what you think are going to be combat-ready models before you've finished the testing.
And by the time you've tested the airplane and realized it's a disaster, you've already bought a huge number of them. You're committed, as we say in the Pentagon, you've gotten pregnant, right? And that's the whole purpose of concurrent development. Is to get the public, the taxpayer, the Congress, everybody committed to this flow of money before you know anything about whether the money is going for anything worthwhile.
Lockheed Martin is the number one defense contractor in terms of spending. Since 1989, Lockheed Martin has made more than $21 million in campaign contributions to Congress.
So Buck McKeon, for example, who heads the Armed Services Committee in the House, gets $750,000 for his campaigns just since 2009.
And then for the defense industry, the lifeblood on Capitol Hill is lobbying.
When big defense contractors pay lobbyists in Washington, it's actually some of the best money they spend. The return on their investment tends to be huge.
They have 1,000 lobbyists or more, about 2 for every member of Congress.
The amount of money that's gone into making sure that this plane kept flying, that the development kept going, there's been so much spin on this in terms of convincing Congress and convincing the American public, too, that this is a wonderful plane.
And, of course, they're funding about 1 out of every 10 members of Congress as part of the Joint Strike Fighter Caucus. Members who've got maybe part of an engine built here, tire is built there, and they get behind it because they can say, you know, it's jobs for my district.
The defense manufacturers are selling big time the jobs they say they're creating. What we found there was that the numbers were grotesquely inflated. In other words, they don't just count line worker riveting wings at the Fort Worth plant. They also count the McDonald's off the plant because somebody going home is going to buy a Big Mac. And that, of course, is the job generated by the F-35, they claim. That's an effort to get the hook in with members of Congress, to intimidate them that if they side against the airplane, there's going to be X number of jobs lost.
They'd say, oh my goodness, this is going to cost 1 million jobs. Never mind whether it works or not, you know. We got to keep building it because we got to keep people working.
But the defense budget is a lousy engine for jobs.
If you take any dollar of government spending, education, health, or just tax cuts, you get more bang for the buck than you do in defense.
$1 billion to, it's about 11,000 jobs if you put it into the military. Transportation generates about 17,000 jobs, about 19,000 if you put it into healthcare, even more if you put it into education. Putting all that spending back into the private economy generates more jobs than are generated by military spending.
Contractors are all interested in making sure that their programs have smooth sailing through the Pentagon and through Congress, and a key mechanism to make sure that happens is the revolving door.
People who are in positions of power in the Pentagon can leave their government jobs where they've been in positions of approving contracts, and after a short cooling off period, can then go to work for the very companies whose contracts they approved.
So what this revolving door system does is make sure the F-35 program survives, no matter how screwed up it is.
The F-35, touted as a tremendous boon to American air power, in fact, is a terrible weakening of American air power. Every extra F-35 we buy means American air power has gone downhill. First of all, simply because everyone we buy will be essentially useless in combat and a danger to the pilot. Secondly, because of the huge expense.
There's huge overhead. They're not adequately audited.
We don't know where all that money is going because the program hasn't had that kind of audit. It desperately needs that kind of audit.
You know, if you or I can't pass an audit, we're in trouble. Pentagon can't pass an audit. We throw them another $700 billion as if nothing's happened.
The most important thing people can do about it is to demand the truth, to write to their congressmen about the horrible waste of money, to vote against congressmen who vote for it, and to demand that the media come up with the truth. Cutting defense is the only way to reform this monster.
People are going to start to understand, if you look carefully at what the Pentagon and the contractors are doing, much of this is not defending us. It's just defending their bottom lines. It's not defending the country.
That was the video. Then there is another hyperlink. It is to a page that says the following. Hypersonic X-51A scramjet failure perplexes Air Force Space.com staff, July 27, 2011. X-51A waiver rider test flight. Ground crew members make the final checks to the X-51A waiver rider scramjet, which is affixed to an Edwards B-52H Stratofortress, before the waiver rider's June 13 flight test. Air Force engineers are scratching their ends after a test flight of an experimental hypersonic X plane ended last month prematurely when the vehicle failed to reach full power. A rocket successfully boosted the hypersonic X-51A waiver rider vehicle to just over 5 times the speed of sound (Mach 5) on June 13. The experimental craft's air-breathing scramjet engine then lit briefly on ethylene but failed to transition to its primary JP-7 fuel, Air Force officials said. The X-51A attempted to restart but was unsuccessful. It continued in a controlled flight orientation, eventually splashing down in the Pacific Ocean in the Point Mugu Naval Air Test Range off the California coast. Obviously, we're disappointed and expected better results, but we are very pleased with the data collected on this flight, said Charlie Brink, the Air Force Research Laboratory's X-51A program manager, in a statement. Most destructive space weapon concepts. The test, which began when a B-52 Stratofortress mothership dropped the X-51A from an altitude of about 50,000 feet (15,240 meters), was the experimental vehicle's second free-flying flight. The first occurred in May 2010, and it was more successful, with the X-51A scramjet engine operating for more than 2 minutes. Boeing and Pratt & Whitney Rocketdyne developed and built the X-51A, an effort to demonstrate a viable hypersonic flight concept. Hypersonic flight is generally defined as anything reaching speeds above Mach 5 (3,805 miles per hour), or 6,124 kph, at sea level (. Engineers at the two companies, as well as the Air Force Research Lab, are reviewing the test flight's telemetry data in an attempt to identify what went wrong this time, officials said. We will continue to examine the data to learn even more about this new technology, Brink said. Every time we test this new and exciting technology, we get that much closer to success. The next test flight for the X-51A is tentatively slated for sometime this fall, Air Force officials said. That is the end of that article about the partial failures of the X-51A. Now back to the final paragraph on my anti-war article on why being nice allows war. Our arrogance, the pleasure filter, the notion that we must only compliment each other, our tolerance of censorship and war, etc., all of which I've shown here are really the same thing or are at least interrelated, is probably my biggest pet peeve, but it is clear from this example alone that I'm unlikely to have the time to properly explain my unique perspectives on these issues to those who might benefit the most without triggering their quote a criticism ejection switch mechanism unquote that is ironically the true cause of this problem. Yes. What is ironic is that our problem is the problem. Sort of a catch-22 situation, you see. In other words, the pleasure filter can be invoked to censor any evidence or messenger showing that it may be systemically wrong. Therefore, if you assume it to be correct, you cannot disprove it, since such a proof could be dismissed on the grounds that it is too negative. To be clear, what is negative here is the possibility that one's entire thought process is a bunch of bunk. So you basically have to place the pleasure filter above the vulnerability of an attack by the force of reason. This is very interesting. If one can place anything above the force of reason itself becomes completely vulnerable and subservient to whatever was/is placed above it. In other words, if reason has any utility whatsoever, the pleasure filter is worthless. Sadly, it is not black and white, and not all thoughts of very nice people are wrong. Rather, They can be right, just as so too can a person guessing correctly on a multiple choice exam. But, mostly as I promised, you either have to subscribe to rational thought or you have to subscribe to the pleasure filter and potentially irrational thought. Not both. I, for one, pick the former.
So, that's my Facebook post about how being nice can lead to war, ironically. One of my friends, Jamie Kern, asked me to explain to him that last paragraph, and it was a little bit hard for him to follow it. So, maybe if I explain it again, it'll be good for the listener. All it's trying to say is that you can't have partial rationality. You can't have rationality and then a pink elephant in the room that gets in the way of it. It just, they interfere. You either have rationality or you don't. And his argument to me was, well, I disagree, and here's an example. Let's say that being nice can save you time. And that's my filter, and it saves me time. That's rational. Therefore, it's a rational filter. That type of thing is actually an argument that what I just said is actually an argument that it is rational to be partially irrational, and that's completely true. But it doesn't change the fact that it's irrational to have the pleasure filter in the first place. So yes, pragmatically, it's rational to not think about everything in great detail, or to be nice and to not revisit topics. But it is not going to lead you to the truth necessarily. It's just going to save you time at the expense of the extent by which you're rational. So in a nutshell, you can't have something that gets in the way of rationality. It's a big deal. So if you want to have place God before rationality, or a pleasure filter that you must be nice, or a belief that you should be nice in front of rationality, or even behind it, it's really not going to come behind it, because you can't put one in front of the other, really. At the end of the day, either you have rationality or you don't. And you can have, you can have less rationality with various filters and stuff like that. But the point is, being nice leads to irrational decisions. So, but that doesn't talk about the reason that being nice leads to war. That actually came in the middle of there, where I discuss how people can get segregated into different belief systems, and these different groups can sort of oppose each other better if everybody's trying to be nice, because really being nice is a type of dishonesty. It's a way of withholding your real feelings, and that's the trigger. That's what allows the bigger explosive outburst to be able to explode. It's sort of like the chemical potential necessary for the more aggressive action that somebody sanctions or authorizes as a collective whole or individually. I also got a comment from my brother Abraham Taylor. He makes several points. The first one is that I have a lot of tangential subjects that I should probably cut out, and this is too long. And that's sort of by design, but it's sort of just because there's a lot of material here. The reason it's by design is because I sort of assume other people are like me. And for me, I consume podcasts and audio material while I'm doing something else, like, say, taking a shower. And so the longer it is, so long as it's good content, the better, because I want to consume that. But so long as it's making that time more valuable than it would be otherwise, and it's what I want. And in this case, I have thrown in here a 45-minute video of an airplane that probably most people don't care about. But at the same time, I sort of think people might care about it. And I mean, some of these things are interrelated. So for instance, at the risk of doing exactly what you just warned me not to do, my criticisms of the F-35 program, like specifically the fact that they ended up needing a clutch and a transmission to convert the torque from the engine to a ducted fan in the front. And at the time this was being designed, they actually went out and solicited opinions about how to best do this. And my own opinion was that this is a bad idea in the first place, because in a car you have a transmission and you have a clutch and you shift gears and it works great 99% of the time, but that 1% of the time that it doesn't work, you have issues. And that works fine in a car. It's okay to like accidentally go between first gear and third gear. But in a flying vehicle, it's not okay. You can't have that kind of reliability. You need closer to 99.99999% or something even much higher. So the design decision to use that comes from the management style that's currently being used in the military. So I think this desire to be nice in our society has changed some ways of management, and in other ways it's gotten better, don't get me wrong. But a lot of these things overlap is my point. To be specific, did that boss want to see that the approach that they were going was bad? No, he didn't want to. They didn't want that short-term pain. They already had a contract. They already had a design. They didn't want to hear anything bad. So they ignored that information. And you have to think, you have to wonder, in the military, who gets promoted? Is it going to be the person who's complaining to the boss that nothing works or this is not working? No. It's going to be the person who says, Sarge, you're awesome. You're 100%. That's who's going to get promoted. And so when you have people who are marshmallows trying to decide which way to go in a little tiny airplane project, and they ignore the warnings from people like me, you can sort of expect that they might end up with a long-term trillion-dollar overrun in the budget. But that may be okay, but it's probably painful. It wasn't a good idea, in my opinion. So this Joint Strike Fighter, or F-35 story, becomes an example of what I'm trying to teach, that SL behavior leads to war and being nice leads to war. And at the end of the day, if you don't understand that that's actually just an example of what I'm trying to teach, that I sort of did pick at random, it'll be perceived as a tangent. But you have to understand something. In my opinion, I have access to a vast reservoir of unknown material to you. And so it's difficult for me to communicate what is sort of a huge paradigm shift in a lot of different areas easily. And so I'm picking a few things here and a few things here as examples to teach. And more they're related. The better you understand this, the better you'll understand the HLSL talk. And that's the problem. And that's why it appears I'm going off in a tangent. And they're really just examples. I'm throwing in there, injecting in there to better teach the material so that you understand it better. It's true that the video that the 45-minute audio from that doesn't belong. I could make a much shorter version of this, but I'm assuming there are other people like me who don't mind something that's very long-winded. And yeah, I probably should make a short version of this for people who just want the question answered, how do you stop war? It's a good idea. Thank you very much for your comment and for your other really great questions that I will also make an attempt to answer now. Abe also argues that being nice lubricates the conversation and allows it to occur when it wouldn't be occurring otherwise. And therefore, being nice allows people to decrease disagreements, and that would lead to less conflict and ultimately less war. And I should caution that I am interpreting the question quite a bit. You're welcome to go on a Facebook to read the original comment and question. To some extent, there's some truth here, but the main thing that being nice does is it actually prohibits conversation about the emotional topics. This is actually version 2 of this MP3 file. In the first version, I didn't really get into this very much. I did discuss feelings, but I didn't use the word emotions. Abe argues that we don't want the emotional aspects of the conversation to dominate. Instead, we want to talk about the formal issues at hand. And the problem with that is that you can only go so far with that kind of reasoning. You won't get to where the emotions really lie. And so I actually think that being nice may lubricate a conversation and allow it to occur. I don't deny that. I think that doing that results in a useless conversation, or at least one that doesn't have as much utility. But I'm actually not saying that being mean will necessarily make world peace. I'm actually saying that there's a system of etiquette that would ostracize anybody who would touch a taboo subject, especially an emotional subject, and that the emotional subjects that you think should not be talked about, or at least the emotion should not be there in the conversation, I'm saying that's the critical part. Abe also asks, I think you understand my criticism. However, I disagree with your premise that people are rational. People have an overall rational part of them that ideally dominates. However, oftentimes emotional concerns, fear, or baser needs like sex or food drive people. It is my belief that the most recent Iraq war was started by George Bush due to irrational concerns, possibly his personal animosity towards Saddam Hussein, which might have begun with the interaction between George Senior Bush and Hussein long ago. So in other words, there's a personal vendetta. This is why being nice is important. Perhaps if someone had dealt with George Bush's emotions by being nice, by helping him deal with his emotional disconnect so that he could once again be rational, we wouldn't have gone to war. Well, as a preliminary question, are people rational or are they not? There are two different variables going on with rationality when it pertains to humans. First of all, there's the overall intelligence of somebody, and then there's also the arrogance of that person. So, for instance, you could have somebody who's really not smart. Maybe they had a bunch of head injuries, but maybe they're not arrogant. That person could be persuaded that something is true, and there would, as a result, be agreement between an average person and that person who's not that smart. There's also, as another example, the case where somebody's extremely smart but has a whole bunch of biases, emotions, in their hidden assumptions. And that's the person who is also irrational, despite how smart they are. The thing that's interesting about this person, because of their arrogance, they are not going to agree with people. So there are real cognitive differences between people. I'll give you that much. But, and this is a big but, it's not my premise that people are rational. It's actually the opposite, that people are irrational for very specific reasons, namely to save time, and also because it's a requirement of consciousness itself. And moreover, that if you go down to the microscopic level, the neural net, that you can actually understand why those feelings are there. And you can ask, why are these two neural nets disagreeing? And you can get to the exact reasons, these state variables that I showed have to exist in any conscious entity back in 1987, in my 87 unpublished but distributed paper. So my way of doing this was to utilize a result from my prior work on neural nets which I could then apply on a larger scale. So in a sense, it's similar to the way that Boltzmann discovered the equation he became most famous for by looking at quantum mechanics, although arguably he didn't really know that he was discovering quantum mechanics at that time. Maybe if I have time, I'll make another MP3 file on that issue. That's how I was able to understand why people really disagree. It's their state variables, it's their feelings, it's their emotions. So the premise is that if we allow people to get rid of their arrogance, if their arrogance comes down a notch, then those cherished beliefs and feelings are less cherished, and they're now vulnerable to attack and discussion, and really subject to the force of reason. And at that point, the differences in two people, whether they're irrational or not, can be reconciled. And two people can agree, even if they're both wrong. And so that's actually the issue here, whether people can agree or not. But what I showed is that the pleasure filter interferes with this process. So it's a specific type of irrationality that prevents people from agreeing. The original version of that last paragraph did not say that. But if I had time, it should distinguish between being irrational and the specific aspect that it's a type of irrationality that creates disagreement. Thank you for helping me refine, alter, improve, amend my thoughts on these issues. I think your example of the Iraq War is extremely good to talk about, because although that view makes good sense, let's take a step back and ask ourselves, how did the American public vote this same person in again a second term if they disagreed with his decision, if they thought it was a personal vendetta? I don't think that he would have been able to get away with it. So there's a problem with the simplistic explanation that this was just a personal irrationality of our president. There's something more, in my opinion, going on. Something involving big groups of people, something systemic with society. And now that you've listened to this MP3 file, I hope you have a better idea of what that might be. Abe also pointed out that mentioning that the comments were deleted just distracts from the main message. And this is completely true. But let me nonetheless explain why I mentioned that. This is an audio file mostly about biases. And the biases that we're talking about aren't actually known by the people who use them. And really then, this podcast is about what is unknown. And in order to understand what's unknown, you have to know what you're not seeing. Let's hear it from Rumso.
There are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
The thing that really is unknown here is, when you think about it, if what I've shown is true, wouldn't somebody else have thought of this before? Why is it that if simply by not being so nice we could prevent war, we still go to war? The way I see it, there are three cases. You might think there's only two cases, and those are: case one, what I've shown here is correct, that we could actually stop war just by changing the etiquette of our societies. And in that case, this audio file should go viral and I should become rich and famous. I mean, everybody I have ever met likes peace. The other case is that I'm full of rubbish and there's something fundamentally wrong with what I'm saying. I'm basically dead wrong. And I should address that because it's the logical conclusion you should come to, because the first case isn't happening. We're still at war. Therefore, by that logic alone, there's something wrong with this MP3 file. Most people will probably discount it just for that logic. But there's another possibility too, and that's case three. Case three actually says that I'm arrogant to think that there's just case two, one and two. It could be that there's a case three, that I'm right, but maybe there's another entity involved in making sure that the message doesn't get out. And in that case, you want to know what you don't know. And what you don't know might be the possibility that, for instance, somebody else came up with these same ideas long ago. And really, if you want to have a complete discussion, it comes back to the logic in Gödel's theorem, which is that it's not just the case that something could be true or false. There's also the case where it can be unknown. And I should consider the possibility that this isn't actually the solution. This isn't going to give you world peace, because there's another entity. And understanding what gets deleted has to come into place here, because then you're in a better situation to understand your own biases and also to understand the data you're being given, whether it's legitimately correlated to reality or whether it's conceivably partially filtered. Because filtering is, again, similar to emotions, biases, and feelings. In a sense, it gives you a better feeling for what your biases are, your hidden biases, because maybe you've grown up to hate these ideas. And as crazy as that sounds, Gödel's theorem says you should include it, and therefore it's important information. And think about it. I'm complaining about a $1 trillion project, that Joint Strike Fighter that really didn't produce a single plane and is now nothing. There's a new project, the F-35. That's a lot of money. And of course, it's worth listening to this speech yet again from President Eisenhower.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. First, I should like to express my gratitude to the radio and television networks for the opportunities they have given me over the years to bring reports and messages to our nation. My special thanks go to them for the opportunity of addressing you this evening. 3 days from now, after half a century in the service of our country, I shall lay down the responsibilities of office as, in traditional and solemn ceremony, the authority of the presidency is vested in my successor. This evening, I come to you with a message of leave-taking and farewell, and to share a few final thoughts with you, my countrymen. Like every other citizen, I wish the new president and all who will labor with him Godspeed. I pray that the coming years will be blessed with peace and prosperity for all. Our people expect their president and the Congress to find essential agreement on issues of great moment, the wise resolution of which will better shape the future of the nation. My own relations with the Congress, which began on a remote and tenuous basis when, long ago, a member of the Senate appointed me to West Point, have since ranged to the intimate during the war and immediate post-war period, and finally to the mutually interdependent during these past 8 years. In this final relationship, the Congress and the administration have, on most vital issues, cooperated well. To serve the nation good rather than mere partisanship, and so have assured that the business of the nation should go forward. So my official relationship with the Congress ends in a feeling, on my part, of gratitude that we have been able to do so much together. We now stand 10 years past the midpoint of a century that has witnessed four major wars among great nations, Three of these involved our own country. Despite these holocausts, America is today the strongest, the most influential, and most productive nation in the world. Understandably proud of this preeminence, we yet realize that America's leadership and prestige depend not merely upon our unmatched material progress, riches, and military strength, but on how we use our power in the interests of world peace and human betterment. Throughout America's adventure in free government, our basic purposes have been to keep the peace, to foster progress in human achievement, and to enhance liberty, dignity, and integrity among peoples and among nations. To strive for less would be unworthy of a free and religious people. Any failure traceable to arrogance or our lack of comprehension or readiness to sacrifice would inflict upon us grievous hurt, both at home and abroad. Progress toward these noble goals is persistently threatened by the conflict now engulfing the world. It commands our whole attention, absorbs our very beings. We face a hostile ideology, global in scope, atheistic in character, ruthless in purpose, and insidious in method. Unhappily, the danger it poses promises to be of indefinite duration. To meet it successfully, there is call for not so much the emotional and transitory sacrifices of crisis, but rather those which enable us to carry forward steadily, surely, and without complaint, the burdens of a prolonged and complex struggle with liberty the stake. Only thus shall we remain, despite every provocation, on our charted course toward permanent peace and human betterment. Crises there will continue to be. In meeting them, whether foreign or domestic, great or small, there is a recurring temptation to feel that some spectacular and costly action could become the miraculous solution to all current difficulties. A huge increase in newer elements of our defenses. Development of unrealistic programs to cure every ill in agriculture. A dramatic expansion in basic and applied research. These and many other possibilities, each possibly promising in itself, may be suggested as the only way to the road we wish to travel. But each proposal must be weighed in the light of a broader consideration, the need to maintain balance in and among national programs. Balance between the private and the public economy. Balance between the cost and hoped for advantages. Balance between the clearly necessary and the comfortably desirable. Balance between our essential requirements as a nation and the duties imposed by the nation upon the individual. Balance between actions of the moment and the national welfare of the future. Good judgment seeks balance in progress. Lack of it eventually finds imbalance and frustration. The record of many decades stands as proof that our people and their government have, in the main, understood these truths and have responded to them well in the face of threat and stress. But threats, new in kind or degree, constantly arise. Of these, I mention two only. A vital element in keeping the peace is our military establishment. Our arms must be mighty, ready for instant action, so that no potential aggressor may be tempted to risk his own destruction. Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense.
we have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together. Akin to and largely responsible for the sweeping changes in our industrial military posture has been the technological revolution during recent decades. In this revolution, research has become central. It also becomes more formalized, complex, and costly. A steadily increasing share is conducted for, by, or at the direction of the federal government. Today, the solitary inventor, tinkering in his shop, has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists in laboratories and testing fields. In the same fashion, the free university, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research. Partly because of the huge costs involved, a government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. For every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of new electronic computers. The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded. Yet in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite. It is the task of statesmanship to mold, to balance, and to integrate these and other forces, new and old, within the principles of our democratic system, ever aiming toward the supreme goals of our free society. Another factor in maintaining balance involves the element of time. As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow. During the long lane of the history yet to be written, America knows that this world of ours, ever growing smaller, must avoid becoming a community of dreadful fear and hate, and be instead a proud confederation of mutual trust and respect. Such a confederation must be one of equals. The weakest must come to the conference table with the same confidence as do we, protected as we are by our moral, economic, and military strength. That table, though scarred by many past frustrations, cannot be abandoned for the certainty agony of disarmament of the battlefield. Disarmament with mutual honor and confidence is a continuing imperative. Together we must learn how to compose differences, not with arms, but with intellect and decent purpose. Because this need is so sharp and apparent, I confess that I lay down my official responsibilities in this field with a definite sense of disappointment. As one who has witnessed the horror and the lingering sadness of war, as one who knows that another war could utterly destroy this civilization, which has been so slowly and painfully built over thousands of years, I wish I could say tonight that a lasting peace is in sight. Happily, I can say that war has been avoided. Steady progress toward our ultimate goal has been made, but so much remains to be done. As a private citizen, I shall never cease to do what little I can to help the world advance along that road. So in this, my last good night to you as your president, I thank you for the many opportunities you have given me for public service in war and in peace. I trust in that service, you find some things worthy. As for the rest of it, I know you will find ways to improve performance in the future. You and I, my fellow citizens, need to be strong in our faith that all nations under God will reach the goal of peace with justice. May we be ever unswerving in devotion to principle, confident but humble with power, diligent in pursuit of the nation's great goals. To all the peoples of the world, I once more give expression to America's prayerful and continuing aspiration. We pray that peoples of all faiths, all races, all nations may have their great human needs satisfied, that those now denied opportunity shall come to enjoy it to the full, that all who yearn for freedom may experience its spiritual blessings. Those who have freedom will understand also its heavy responsibility, that all who are insensitive to the needs of others will learn charity, and that the sources, scourges of poverty, disease, and ignorance will be made disappear from the earth, and that in the goodness of time, all peoples will come to live together in a peace guaranteed by the binding force of mutual respect and love. Now, on Friday noon, I am to become a private citizen. I am proud to do so. I look forward to it. Thank you, and good night.
So that's President Eisenhower's speech. Now, which of these three cases is true? I don't know. But at least now maybe you'll understand why maybe it was important to mention that some of my comments are being deleted. I hope you learned something from this. I hope that you think about it. I hope it's persuasive for you to consider the possibility that being nice all the time isn't the best thing in the world necessarily. And if you disagree, by all means, hit me up on Facebook, post a comment. Thank you for listening.